Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
John Hockenberry here. Thank you for downloading this podcast from WNYC and Public Radio International. You're a very discriminating person, I can tell that. Remember, we're as keen to hear from you as we are from John in Dallas or Joan in Eugene. You can follow us on Twitter at The Takeaway and find out more at thetakeaway.org. Here then, for your listening pleasure, is The Takeaway Podcast. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry, remembering shock and awe.
I can tell you that we heard early this morning, you could actually hear in the sky above these troops the sound of the cruise missiles going overhead, heading toward Baghdad. But as people have mentioned thus far, what the commanders here told us is that was not the beginning of the quote-unquote real air war. That was what they call the pre-battle phase. One of these commanders told us that that was just the Operation Southern Watch on steroids.
Iraq 2003 and the late NBC reporter David Bloom on the battlefield sending back live reports. In a moment, the possibility of the U.S. revisiting Iraq as a response to victories by an Islamic group apparently bent on creating a new nation. Also, Bosnia's troubled history and its national pride on the line at the World Cup competition. And how when history disappoints and makes life hopeless, why did the most popular author in the world in the 1940s choose to end his own life? And later this hour, on the Friday before Father's Day, we'll speak to a young man who is doing his best to make unconventional fatherhood work. WNYC's radio rookie Marvin Ramos talks about raising his daughter, Haley. But first, Iraq.
Coalition military operations are focused on achieving several specific objectives. To end the regime of Saddam Hussein by striking with force on a scope and scale that makes clear to Iraqis that he and his regime are finished. Next, to identify, isolate, and eventually eliminate Iraq's weapons of mass destruction, their delivery systems, production capabilities, and distribution networks. Third, to search for, capture, drive out terrorists who have found safe harbor in Iraq.
I mean, as I speak to you, and it's late here, just the ground is shaking from the bombs that are being dropped. Just thunderous, earth-shattering explosions. So it's not over yet, and there's still a lot of fight in these guys.
It's Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld and then reporter Dexter Filkin speaking back in 2003 as the full force of the U.S. invasion was getting underway in Iraq. In 2014, Filkins would still say it's not over yet. Yesterday, militant fighters from ISIS and al-Qaeda splinter group made their way into the city of Kirkuk, advancing their claim on the northern part of the country. ISIS Sunni militants are now said to already control the northern Iraqi cities of Tikrit and Mosul, and in addition, Fallujah. Iraq's senior Shiite leaders issued an urgent call to arms on Friday, telling all able-bodied Iraqis to assist the Shiite-controlled government. And today, during Friday prayers, Grand Ayatollah Ali Sistani, who represents the most senior Shiite cleric in the country, called on all able-bodied of the faithful to pick up arms to fight the Sunni militants. Is Iraq unraveling into the sectarian chaos we saw back in 2006 and 2007? We asked for an assessment of the current situation from now New Yorker writer Dexter Filkins, who has been covering Iraq since the beginning of the U.S. invasion.
I think what's really worrying to me is not just what's happening in Iraq, but that we're beginning to see, and I think we will see, a regional war taking place. And I'd say, you know, regional war meaning from the Iranian border in the east all the way to the Mediterranean. You know, so you've got essentially Iraq and Syria in the middle. The border between those countries is effectively gone. And so you've got these groups like called ISIS. It's basically al-Qaeda. ISIS and the al-Nusra Front, and they're running back and forth. They're fighting on each side. ISIS has carried out bombings in Lebanon, which is a very weak state that's kind of been flooded with Syrian refugees. And you're talking about probably Iranian involvement in probably cranking up the Shiite militias in Iraq to beat back the Sunnis. And so really, you're talking about a big, long sectarian war that stretches across the middle of the Middle East.
It's been predicted that this was a possibility since the end of World War II by various analysts. Do you think that Nouri al-Maliki ultimately has no choice unless the U.S. gives him an option of basically making an overture to Iran, Shiite, to basically hold forth around Baghdad?
It's true that what's happening in Iraq, the sort of Sunni-Shiite fight, is being fueled by the war in Syria, but it's basically being driven by the internal dynamics of Iraq. And Maliki, ever since the Americans left, and that's about 2.5 years ago now, has begun, you know, a very sectarian project. He has taken most of the power in the country for himself. He's oppressed and done mass arrests of Sunnis across the Sunni heartland in the north and west of the country. He's basically marginalized them politically. And so that's opened up the space that these extremists are kind of moving into. In a way, you know, Maliki may turn to the Iranians, but he's already done that. And he is Shiite sectarian to the core. And he has been that way for most of his adult life, but long before the Americans even got to Iraq.
Let's talk about the Syrian end of this, because it seems to me that, and it's really shocking if you look at what's going on right now, that the U.S. in its view of Syria really pretty much viewed that as a Syrian situation. Do you think there was any indication in the State Department or in the Pentagon that some of the various opposition groups within Syria would see the destabilizing of Syria as really an opportunity to launch an offensive into Iraq?
Yeah, I think there's no lack of knowledge in Washington about what's happening. I think what you're seeing is it's a hesitation to do something about it or to get involved. And that's, you know, that's understandable for a lot of reasons, whether it's the right thing to do or not. But look, if you just rewind the clock a little bit, these extremist groups, the two big ones in Syria, there's one called Jabhat al-Nusra, and then the other one is ISIS. And these were both created by former members of al-Qaeda in Iraq. So these were kind of the survivors. I mean, you know, they were essentially all but wiped out during the American war. But, you know, there was a kind of a handful of them who were left. And they literally, I mean, this just happened, you know, a year and a half ago. They crossed the border into Syria and they got the old firm going again. And then they kind of split, you know, ISIS and Nusra, and they don't really agree on everything. But the point is that the border between these two countries, Iraq and Syria, essentially for all practical purposes doesn't exist, and it hasn't for a while. And so these two groups and the extremists on each side of the border, they're basically supporting one another and fighting together on both sides. So it's cutting both ways.
Although what I can't understand is certainly it's a hard argument to make that the U.S. has any strategic interest in getting rid of Hafez al-Assad or Bashar al-Assad, getting rid of the regime in Syria. That feels like a widening of the conflict. But, you know, we did lose 4,000 soldiers in Iraq. There is some sort of investment to maintain some kind of stability in Iraq, yes?
Boy, this may not today threaten the United States, but, you know, the area between Aleppo in Syria and Mosul in Iraq, this vast ungoverned area, it is very rapidly coming to resemble what Afghanistan was before 9/11. And that is a kind of big sanctuary for the most pathological extremists that Islam can produce. And there are, I think the number, the best estimate, there's about 7,000 Sunni jihadis, foreigners, who are fighting against the Assad government. Hundreds of those are from the West, including the United States. So, you know, Germany, the UK, France, and all these people have passports. And so you have to assume that if they survive the fighting, they're going to want to come home at some point. And that's a pretty terrifying prospect, because terrible things happen to people when they go to war. And these guys are already at the far end of the spectrum in terms of, you know, their religious and political extremism. And so I think it's, these groups may not be threatening the United States today, but there's no way that we can safely ignore this absolute cataclysm that's happening in the middle of the Middle East.
The chaos that you're talking about is similar to Afghanistan, but you already have ticked off at least one way in which it's very, very different, and that is the very deep supply of people with Western passports. You've just mentioned that. But you've also got oil wealth that can finance things. You've got airfields in this area, Mosul, Aleppo, Kirkuk. You've got industrial assets. You know, this isn't some Tora Bora cave people zone. This is a real infrastructure, a real nation that's capable of all kinds of things that was never possible in Sudan or Somalia or Afghanistan.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's true. I mean, it's mostly desert, but you're talking about the populations in both of those countries live along the rivers. You know, in Syria, it's the Euphrates, and in Iraq, it's the Tigris and the Euphrates, both. But these are both sophisticated middle-class countries. But, you know, the portrait of the typical foreign jihadi, it's very rarely been a kind of illiterate, you know nothing with no education. It's the opposite. It's somebody who, you know, it's like Mohammed Atta, who carried out the 9/11 attacks. I mean, you know, he lived in Germany, he was educated, and you know, a lot of these guys are very thinking people. And so it's pretty terrifying. I mean, we've seen this movie before, and we know how it ended, and it's starting again.
Veteran Iraq reporter Dexter Filkins is a staff writer for The New Yorker. Coming up, dreaming of a dad who was never there.
You grow up with friends that have dads, and you always feel like you're missing somebody to give you that wisdom at the end of the day, to give you the answers to like questions that just come up all the time. And you end up seeking that wisdom in as many places as you can find.
And one of you says, the dad you dream of might just be enough.
I learned how not to be a husband, how not to be a father, and how not to grow old. I have learned and tell every expectant father I meet that whether or not you had the father you would like to have had, be the father you would like to have had. You can't do any better than that.
No, you can't. Later this hour, 18-year-old Marvin Ramos is doing the best he can, flying solo as a dad because his was never there, just like the mother of his child, Stephanie.
I mean, I didn't get my high school diploma. Sorry. I did want a dad. I did want one so badly. Because all my friends had one. I always seen them get picked up by them in school. They will have someone to go hug. And I never had that. I never had a dad to come and say stuff, you know. That's why I hate guys that run away from their daughters or sons. That just makes me not want to believe anybody. Because they could just run away from you at any point of their life.
Coming up, a reporter on the front lines of new fatherhood. Father's Day is this Sunday. Not everyone has a dad to celebrate, but there's still something to celebrate. There's someone who stepped into that role for you. Tell us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Be a part of the conversation. Tell us a story. Happy Father's Day. It's all about stepping up. You can find us at facebook.com/thetakeaway. The World Cup is a tournament that places sweaty young athletes on a field of competition that sometimes evokes some very old history. For host Brazil, it's a nation's proud championship past coming together with its emergence as an economic powerhouse. That pride swept aside Team Croatia, you could hear yesterday, with the help of some dubious officiating. On Sunday, the ghosts of 19th century Europe will take the field when Bosnia-Herzegovina takes on the mighty Argentina. It'll be the first time Bosnia will compete in the final since claiming independence from Yugoslavia in 1992. And for Bosnian national Kenan Trbinčević, this weekend's match is a chance to remind people how far Bosnians have come since their own bloody war in the 1990s. Kenan is the author of The Bosnia List, a memoir about the war that tore Yugoslavia apart when the only thing holding it together was soccer. There's also a lot at stake for opponent Argentina with its own history of revolution and state-sponsored brutality. The last time a Bosnian player went to the tournament for the Yugoslavian team was in 1990, and they lost in the quarterfinals on penalties against Argentina. For Kenan, this weekend's World Cup encounter is much more than a game.
This game has become our weapon to win back our pride and place, you know, in a sports arena. And that's what I'm really, you know, looking forward to. And when I went back on my trip, I realized that, you know, I never made sense of how and why we survived. And at first I felt like a young boy who lost his happy childhood. But in the end I realized how amazingly lucky we were. And I realized that the war even brings worst or best out of people. And I feel bad for my parents mostly because, you know, they lived one big lie in Yugoslavia, which was a hybrid country. And as a child, I believe that, you know, my karate coach, our neighbors turned on us overnight. But, you know, I don't think it was overnight. The war allowed him to be who they truly were. And it was nothing personal. It was just, you know, pure hatred and nationalism.
You know, Americans traditionally don't follow the World Cup and don't get into it. And they think of it as just some kind of obsession that the rest of the world has. Can you explain through your history how the World Cup evokes this deep sense of personal history and national pride in almost every country? For Bosnia, it's one story, but it's there for almost every team and every fan.
For, like, for example, for South Americans, many, I don't want to generalize, it's a way out of poverty. So Brazilians, Argentinians, as you come across players like Neymar and Messi, you know, they came from nowhere. And I really believe people live vicariously through them. Unfortunately, in the Balkans, it's the way to vent your frustration. So there's always a couple hundred idiots who go on a field and they'll bring posters of war criminals like Milosevic and Ratko Mladic. Soccer games tend to turn into violence in the Balkans.
Let me read you a scene from your book from your first day, I believe, in an American school. You're having trouble imagining how you would trust anybody, making friends. I can imagine how just uncomfortable you must have felt. You write, "Most of my old playmates from Bosnia, along with my former martial arts coach and favorite teacher, hated me and wanted me to die. I pretended not to care, but I did. I held on to each slight from my past, replaying the demeaning betrayals in my mind. I couldn't let go of my bad memories. Everything was too important to me." And this is what's going through your mind on your first day of an American school. At recess, that first day of school in America, everyone was pointing to the new foreign kid. Miguel handed me a basketball. I threw the ball at the backboard carefully and made the shot. Miguel gave me a high five. And here's what he asked you. "What's your favorite soccer team?" "Mine's Real Madrid," he told me. "Yugoslavia no more," I said, regretting that my favorite had split up just like my country. Wow. Soccer united you in Yugoslavia when you were there and was your entrance to America on the first day of school.
It was always part of cultural identity in Balkans, like soccer and martial arts. I remember like the 1990 World Cup, we went outside, we're chanting like Yugoslavia, all the kids. And we went up to buy white T-shirts, and we stenciled them with blue numbers. So what we'd do is we would play soccer till dusk or until our mothers yelled at us to come inside and eat. And we would play till, you know, we couldn't see soccer ball anymore. And we used to shout out live-time commentaries, imagining commentaries. There were those players, and someday will be them, and people will look up to us. And I remember that I was sitting, I remember in May 9th or May 10th in 1992 on my living room floor when the war started, and I was looking through soccer sticker album. I was 11, and I remember looking at Alexi Lalas, if you know Alexi Lalas, and Tony Miola, famous American goalie, and that's when I heard a loud knock on a door, and it was karate coach who came to our door and told us we had 1 hour to leave or be killed.
Wow. You describe, you know, in this terrific book, The Bosnia List, what it was like to take all of your memories and your feelings back to Bosnia and try to relive or settle some of those scores. Yeah. Here's how you described yourself. I was the little shrimp outside on the stairwell who every day was picked on by former friends, spit at, denied food in stores, hit, tripped on the steps, and shot at. My suffering was interactive. With so much FaceTime on the streets with Serbs, the confrontations I craved now were more personal, speaking of your return to Bosnia. The list was becoming my scheduling book, security blanket, preparation tool, medicine to stem the pain, and symbol of my control. We had 7 days in Bosnia. I might never go back. I didn't want to be left with eternal regrets. Meanwhile, I couldn't stop reliving all those times I'd walked through our building with Mom, watching the pain on her face as Petra toyed with her, a particular memory that you have of someone who was intolerant to you. "You won't be needing that carpet," Petra had said before taking the black and white rug my mother had treasured. I was haunted by not being able to protect Mom when I was 12. I couldn't even argue. I was muffled then, since Petra could have turned us into the police at any moment. The story here, you go back.
Yep.
You take your revenge and your powerful memories with you. On that soccer field, how much of Bosnia's performance is going to be, in some sense, an echo of your personal revenge if they do well?
Even qualifying for World Cup is a victory against those who want to see Bosnia dissolve. You know, this country is split into two regions. And, you know, there are, of course, Serbs and plenty of Croats who want to see Bosnia succeed and win. And many fantasize that this will unify the country.
Do you believe that?
No, I don't. I mean, because the other half of the country mostly does not want to see Bosnia win. Because during the games, qualifying games, we see in the news, you know, who they chant for. I mean, we can be playing Mars. They're going to, you know, cheer against Mars. Mm. But those who are part of the squad, they're very pro-Bosnian, and they want to see independent Bosnia where all different factions you know, live together in peace.
Kenan Trbinjevic is the author of The Bosnia List, and he's headed to Rio to cheer on his team this Sunday in their first match against Argentina. To be a good dad, do you need a good dad?
I can't understand why my dad gave up on me. I'm working, and I'm young. I've been working since I was 14. Anything I have in my closet or anything that I have personally is because of me. I worked hard for myself. Nobody gave me $10 every day. I wish I got that.
Marvin Ramos wishes a lot of things in his life. He wishes that his dad had been there for him.
You know how that makes me feel? Like I ain't nobody.
Marvin wishes he didn't drop out of school for a while. He wishes he was more prepared to be a dad, which he is now, an 18-year-old dad. This will be his second Father's Day and the first one where he is really engaged with his daughter, Haley. This Brooklyn dad comes from a family where being a young father is not unusual. Baby Haley already has a bunch of cousins from Marvin's three brothers, also young or even teen dads. Marvin bravely shared his story when he decided to become a radio reporter with Radio Rookies at our partner station WNYC. And suddenly, he had questions for himself and for his own biological father, like, what is a good father?
No, mijito, no.
No, my son, no.
Yo no fui un buen padre, hijo.
No, I was not a good father, my son. Providing anything you wanted is not the same as being a good father. I always put work first, and on my days off, I would head to the streets to be with my friends. I never took you guys to the park. I drank. I don't know why. Drinking was the way I had fun.
A few days ago, Marvin Ramos sat down dad to dad in the studio with me. We could hardly be more different. I had the first of my 5 kids when I was 42. My dad was always around when I was growing up. But we discovered a kind of universal brotherhood of the dad experience, from the really big stuff to all the little things.
It was hard, buying the diapers, buying the wipes, buying them Similac. Like, I ain't have no help. It was the first 3 months that I wasn't really being, like, helping my baby's mom like that. And my mom told me, you know, you can't just think about financially, you know, being taken care of. You have to love them. Like with a bond, you know. You have to bond with them. You know, that's your family now. Like, when I started seeing her crawl and her have a better relationship with her mother than me, so I felt like I needed to engage myself more with my daughter. I just wanted her to feel that, you know, that I'm there, you know.
That you're somebody.
Yeah, that I'm somebody. Always put her on my arms and put her to sleep. And then as I saw her sleep on her nap, it's like I was proud of myself. I patted myself on my back. Like, putting on music that I know that she'll probably be able to dance to, like playing her first favorite song, Robin Thicke, Blur Lines.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. Just putting on that on and seeing her smile, her laugh, her screams, it just makes me happy. Like, damn, I'm doing it.
Are you making it up as you go along? Who's helping you with this?
Nobody. Like, just my girlfriend. I think that she helped me during the times that she needed to tell me, like, you need to step it up. You need to like show her love. Like, you don't want her to love your brother more than you.
You know, it's a long game, this dad business. It's, you know, it's more than four quarters. It's, if you just count years, it's 18.
Yeah.
And then it's not even done. Did your dad give up on you?
He left. So I feel like he did. I didn't see nobody doing what they got to do to their kid, you know, like feed them. I didn't really see that from a father. So, yeah. I didn't have a model. Like, I'm just learning off what my dad did, you know? He just had time when he wanted to with us. So I'm gonna try to give the best time to my daughter. Something that I ain't have sometimes.
She got any words yet?
She said thank you to me.
Yeah?
I asked her if I've been doing good with her. And out of nowhere, she said thank you, and you could just hear it.
Bye-bye. Say thank you.
Ooh.
Tell him in good. Tell him in good job to the dads that are doing it, right?
Thank you.
Say thank you.
Huh? Thank you. It's like wow. Like thanks. Like thanks, Haley. Like, that was my favorite part.
What's this radio story? Project doing for you in terms of understanding what it means to be a dad?
It's teaching me a lot. It's a hard question.
Well, you know, a lot of dads, and it sounds like yours is one of them, they don't get a chance or take a chance to look at themselves, see what it is they're doing. With this radio project, and it's really brave of you, you're taking a good long look at yourself. And that's hard. A lot of 30-year-olds can't do that. A lot of 50-year-olds can't do that. What has it taught you?
Like, just be there. Like, you don't want them running to anyone else but you. I don't want her to be alone, cry alone. I want her to be with me. I know I'm young. I know that I'm still in high school trying to get a diploma this year. But when I'm done with this high school, I'm seriously getting closer to my family. I want to work on that. It's hard for me. Like, I want to work hard so I could get a house before I even get a car. Because a car, you can't really sleep comfortable.
You can't sleep in a car.
I know. That's why I ain't too focused in buying a car. Like,
what about getting married?
Getting married?
Yikes!
I know that's like every girl wants get married with someone they love.
Did your girlfriend want that?
I asked her, and she said, you know, like we have to work on our relationship, you know, before it even gets there. Stephanie, like, she showed me what love was, so it's like. I told her, like, there's no, like, I won't give up on her if I had to win her again, you know, if anything was to happen. I'm all about completing a goal if I have to. I want to work on being the greatest boyfriend to husband, from not being a so good father from the first 3 months to being a moderate father, good, doing good, until, like, I want to be the greatest father, you know?
All right, so let's think about this fatherhood goal. What's the top of the mountain here? What's the moment that if you hang in there, give it your all, do everything that you know you can do and all that stuff you don't know because you didn't have much of a model. What's the moment that'll say to you, I was a good dad? What do you want for Haley that's going to say, well, I did my job?
Personally, to like, to always like bond with her, to always be there with her, even if she's sick, even if she's not sick, even if she's sleeping, always be there. Like, bond with her, like, don't let her be alone, you know, spend the greatest times with her when they're young, because when they get older, they want to do what they want to do. And then when they get older, they'll remember, like, wow, I had a great dad.
Well, Marvin, happy Father's Day. I think it's going to be a good one.
Yeah.
And, you know, just because I want to say it, happy next Father's Day, too.
Thanks. You make me get closer.
Marvin Ramos is 18 years old and father to Haley. This weekend, he'll be celebrating his second Father's Day with his daughter. Marvin's story is part of a WNYC series called Educating on the Edge, an American Graduate, a public media initiative addressing the dropout crisis supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. To hear Marvin's full story, you can check out our website at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. Happy Father's Day to everyone out there. And remember, it's never too late to step up. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.